This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio. Carbondale, Glenwood Springs, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. It is 4 p.m. on a Thursday, time again for Everything Under the Sun. I'm your host, Raleigh Burley, and today's guest is John Waterman, who is an author, photographer, adventurer, featured in an article in last week's edition of the Sopra Sun. John will also be presenting his new book, Into the Thaw, at an event tomorrow night, 7 p.m., at the 3rd Street Center. John, welcome to our show today.
It's a pleasure to be with you here in the studio.
And you're no stranger to KDNK. You've been here in the past?
Yes, I have. But I've probably done a score of interviews over the last month, but this is the only studio interview I've done. It's always been over a phone or the internet.
And has it been live?
Very rarely.
Okay, cool. We have that extra high stakes of a live interview.
Yeah, that's great.
But you're very versed now in presenting this book in particular. You've been touring around the country in recent weeks and months. How has that been for you personally?
Well, it's a great thing for me as an author because much of my job is performed in isolation. So getting out in the world, as I have been the last few weeks, allows me to potentially connect with my audience. So I love it, actually. I like talking to lecture halls and broadcasters, etc.
And as you present the book, do you ever have things jump out that you think, oh, I should have included that? Spontaneous things that come out during the lectures?
Well, now that you mention it, my spontaneous event for the day that connects us all to the Arctic was lounging on my deck this afternoon. Lo and behold, a flock of sandhill cranes went by, the unmistakable croaking as they flew by. You don't hear them often around here, but those sandhill cranes quite potentially could be winging their way down from the Arctic on their way to New Mexico or points further south. And it's not only the birds that connect us, the over 200 species of birds in the Arctic that connect us to that place, that come winging through our neighborhoods, but it's the weather. It's the changes in the Atlantic currents. The Arctic is an important place.
Mm-hmm. And also home to so much permafrost, right?
I'm glad you bring that up because most people's conception of the climate change in the Arctic is about sea ice, which is one of the dominoes, but the other big domino knocking over more dominoes is the underlying ground. It's frozen, places a mile deep, frozen dirt, solid ice, and that is abruptly thawing and has been for the last couple of decades, which is accelerating the change not only in the Arctic but releasing more gases, greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And so just to set this up a little bit for our audiences who are completely unfamiliar, when was the first time that you ventured to the Arctic?
I first went to the Arctic in 1983 on a Park Service exchange patrol. I worked at Denali National Park, and I was sent to Gates of the Arctic National Park. And what I saw there blew my mind. There were thousands of caribou migrating through. We discovered, the other ranger and I discovered, a wolf den with five pups. We watched a grizzly bear consume a caribou from a safe distance, of course.
Wow.
And over that week-long trip, we didn't see any other people. It changed my life. It really did change my life. And I began taking trips to the Arctic over the next few decades. I didn't return to that particular place, Gates of the Arctic National Park, for more than 30 years. And when I returned in 2021 with my 15-year-old son, Alistair, I was stunned by the changes that I saw there because I had it, you know, sort of firmly implanted in my memory, this beautiful place that changed my life, was overgrown with brush. The river was flooding in ways that I'd never seen it flood in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And instead of thousands of caribou in the space of a week's time on 100 miles of river, we saw only one caribou.
Wow.
So I realized that, of course, I knew that the climate was changing, but this this special place really dramatically called my attention to the extent of the change, and I decided that I had to go back the following year, 2022, to investigate more thoroughly. And I did that with a friend and a very talented photographer and kayaker, Chris Korbulik. Mm-hmm. And we traveled more than 500 miles, and that is what inspired the book.
Right. But I love how the book doesn't just focus on that journey. It also jumps through time. It includes some of your photographs from earlier expeditions.
Yeah. You know, I had fallen in love with the place, and I had immersed myself in it, and took long solo journeys, had many bear encounters. Mm-hmm. And many adventures, and learned a lot, moreover, from the culture, from the Inuit and the Inupiat people, whom mm-hmm. I learned to listen to, who actually were the most generous and noble people I've ever met. Also the toughest people on the earth, the most adaptable people on the earth with what they have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And I love that reverence that really comes through in the book as well for the native peoples of the Arctic Circle, and acknowledging how strong they are and how innovative to live in a place that's quite harsh. And do you feel that it's common for people to approach them, to listen, and to see from their perspective the changes?
Yeah, I think so, but it's very hard to really kind of get on their wavelength. And I was fortunate because in the 40-some-odd years that I've traveled there, in many instances, in some instances, I paddled alone into their hunting camps and villages in their mythical tool, the kayak, which they invented mm-hmm. thousands of years ago. So I actually they welcomed me with open arms. They were curious about these journeys that I was taking. And in turn, that gave me the opportunity to badger them with questions. And they don't normally like to be asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an inside track, if you will.
Well, and I imagine on those solo expeditions especially, but even with just one companion, that those villages are much more receptive to foreigners.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, with a foreign culture like this, one has to be sensitive to their needs and their identities. And we always ask permission before taking photographs, and photographs I published in the book, I got permission for all those photographs. In fact, I've repeatedly arranged large donations of winter gear for all these villages that I've spent time in, mm. where I was, you know, obviously interviewing people about their lives.
Mm-hmm. Great. For listeners who are just tuning in, we are speaking with John Waterman, author of several books, including Into the Thaw, his newest book, and a book that you have described as being very near to your heart. It's looking back and reminiscing a lot on your life. And it's also beautifully published by Patagonia. It was your first time working with them. How was that experience?
Well, I've had the opportunity in my career publishing more than a few books with the big publishers in New York, and repeatedly also with the National Geographic to work with the best publishers in the business. But Patagonia, as far as I'm concerned, is the, you know, the great watershed of my career as an author, because they've not only taken incredible care of me, but they really walk the talk. For instance, you can open the book to the copyright page and you'll see an environmental benefits statement. And they state exactly how many trees were used in the first printing of this book. They print only on post-consumer waste recycled paper. In other words, this paper in this book was bound for the dump. Mm. And the way they get away with that is that they print only in Canada, because if they printed in Asia, they wouldn't be able to guarantee that that was post-consumer waste recycled paper. But they also print in Canada because they don't want to incur the greenhouse gas emissions that most publishers like the National Geographic routinely incur by shipping thousands of books on ships across the oceans from Asia, where who knows what kind of, you know, human rights issues are being violated by these workers in the printing sweatshops. So they've leveraged their incredible vision as a clothing company into printing books as well, with just the same sort of integrity and attention to environmental issues.
Well, it's also extraordinarily beautiful. The page quality, the feeling of the pages, the sharpness of the photographs and the way they hold the ink.
Yeah, thank you. That's true because they've mastered a process in rejuvenating that recycled paper so that it'll accept colored ink, which isn't easy to do, which also couldn't be done in Asia. I've never had a publisher that's gone to these sorts of lengths before. It's a great honor to be working with them.
Can you describe the feeling of when you received an early copy and got to flip through it?
Well, what I'm going to say is going to surprise you because I've always found it a tremendous anticlimax when I've received a published book because as authors, maybe I can speak for the collective, we have these expectations of, you know, this work of art and beauty that we've created. And then when it finally arrives, it never meets your expectations. Mm. But I'm told by others that Patagonia has succeeded, and I am inclined to agree. I think they did an amazing job, and I'm proud of the work. But also the work has a message. It has an important message. The subtitle of this book is Witnessing Wonder Amid the Arctic Climate Crisis. And there's a couple of things I want to point out about that subtitle. And one is that I do believe that there is hope for these issues of changing climate. And I've had the opportunity to witness so much beauty and wonder in my travels across the Arctic that it would have been silly not to include that, even amid these changing landscapes. But the other part of that subtitle is climate crisis. I believe that we're mistaken in calling this change across the Earth a climate change rather than a crisis. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the Arctic, it is crisis because the Arctic has warmed nearly four times faster than the rest of the Earth. And this book lays out exactly what those changes and devastations are.
Well, and despite that, and, you know, you emphasized it to me when we spoke for the interview, it ends with hope. Like, you didn't want a book that is all despair and gloom and, you know, let's throw in the towel, it's too late. Can you speak to where you source that hope and how it weaves into the book?
Well, there's very little despair in the book itself. For instance, you know, we think of these changes as just devastating to the wildlife and the land and the sea, but there's huge repercussions to the culture, to these amazing, noble people, the Inupiat and the Inuit people. And therein, I found tremendous hope. They have, as I mentioned earlier, they are remarkably adaptable and resilient, and even have a sense of humor about some of these changes. And granted, these people, many of them are being forced to relocate because their villages are flooding or about to be inundated by the sea, along with the rivers silting up and change and migrations with the animals that they depend upon. So then to follow through on hope. I think that we live now in an era of, for lack of a better term, climate anxiety. And we're faced with all of these catastrophes, whether it be in Spain or in Western North Carolina. But I think that if people realize that they can take action at if not at the federal level, but with local government, let alone figure out the myriad of ways that even baby steps leading to bigger steps in which we can all reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And I refer people in the appendix of this book ways they might go about that. Moreover, I refer people to the United Nations website, how to take action in the climate change, rather than pretending to be any expert on policy myself.
Right. Well, and it feels increasingly acknowledged that there's not much we can do at this point to stop or reverse what's begun, but we can lessen how dramatic it will be.
Yes, I agree with that. We can't stop this catastrophic change, but we can minimize the impacts. There are many ways to minimize the impacts.
Were there any things that you saw, like it's such a harsh environment, so cold and so much ice, did you see anything thriving that struck you as particularly beautiful as the climate changes as much as it wasn't what you remembered from 40 years ago? Did you see things that moved your soul?
Repeatedly. Thriving, what jumps to mind are there now beavers in the Arctic, in the northwestern Arctic, Alaska. But prior to the mid-1980s, there were no beavers, and researchers recently counted 11,327 new beaver ponds in that section of the Alaskan Arctic alone. So animals are moving north. Things are changing in not necessarily deleterious ways, but in astonishing ways. The land is changing. It's slumping as the permafrost melts from underneath it, and this is not so pleasant or benign, but there's a phenomenon that's occurring across the Arctic called thermokarsting, where you see what looks like landslides on hillsides or in mountainsides, or what looks like sinkholes on flat ground. Those are all known as thermokarsts. But wildlife populations are still intact in many instances. There are astonishing things going on. For instance, grizzly bears have begun mating with polar bears, producing a new hybrid species. Salmon are being found in places they were never seen before. Robins and bluebirds have arrived in the Arctic archipelago of islands in Canada. To think of it all as simply devastating isn't necessarily true in all cases.
That's fascinating. Do you feel you'll continue to visit the Arctic?
Yeah, I have no plans immediately, but it's such a vast place. There are so many places I haven't yet had the opportunity to visit. I've covered thousands of miles. But I would still like to get to the higher Arctic, into the chain of islands in Arctic Canada.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I'd love to rewind and talk a little bit more about your career in general. I think that it's really fascinating that you've boated the Colorado River, starting from the source down to sea. I'm curious to know, did you make it to the sea, or did you have to stop short?
Yeah, well, I did a project for the National Geographic on the Colorado River because I was stunned that my family couldn't use the water from our well in Missouri Heights to irrigate a large vegetable garden. And I decided right then and there that I wanted to learn about water rights and about where all the water goes to and who owns the rights and moreover where the river ended up. And one of the great tragedies, of course, is that this magnificent river, the Colorado, no longer reaches the sea. So in 2008, I boated from the source to the sea, and I took my time doing it. I spent 5 months paddling down the river, a couple of occasions mistakenly swimming the river, but got to the delta across the Mexican border to find, which I knew about beforehand, that the river no longer flowed and ended in a, for lack of a better term, a Frappuccino pit of, you know, water bottles and trash.
Oh, wow.
And then we walked for the next week to get to the sea. But you asked about my career. That was a project for the National Geographic. And I also wrote an op-ed for the New York Times immediately after that trip. knowing that the International Water Commission, International Water Boundary Commission, was deciding on adding a minute to the treaty that would release water into the delta so that it would reach the sea again. And I think in part, you know, my editorial in the New York Times influenced that commission to add that minute to the treaty, which allowed water to flow to the sea the following year and again a couple of years later. So one of my greatest dreams came true, and I had a not a small part in making that happen. So getting back to my career, what's important to me is trying to affect change. And if I can affect change, then I've vastly succeeded. And I can't expect to always affect change, but I continue to try to do that. And I continue to take on these thorny environmental issues. I've published more than a few books about environmental issues, whether it be about diminishing rivers or oil exploitation in the Arctic, or now climate change. And my literary agent, for instance, immediately told me, do not write a book on climate change because it's not going to sell. It's bad news. And I said, I have a lot of wonderful things to write about the Arctic, so it's not all bad news.
Well, and just to say, too, the book is full of fun adventure, getting accidentally sprayed with bear spray. And I love, there's a part in the beginning of the book that talks about how inevitably you spend enough time doing these kinds of things, something goes wrong, the tent blows away.
Yeah. When you go north, inevitably something goes south.
That's it. Yeah. So it's fun and it's comical and it's very reflective, very philosophical at the same time. Beautiful descriptions of the land and flora and fauna. You said to me in our interview that this book did just flow through you, and I think that really is evident.
Yeah, well, thank you. I have written a couple of other books about the Arctic, and the first big book I wrote about the Arctic was really more about culture, about the Inuit culture, that there's people that I learned so much from. But in going through my journals, I realized there were repeated instances where I saw glimmers of change and actual change, albeit much more subtly than in 2022. And I was able to go through my journals and actually parse out those moments in the past. Hence, the book really kind of flowing out of me, as I mentioned, because I had so much to tell that I'd left untold from my journals. In addition to the more recent trips that I did that I hadn't written about at all.
Well, I wanted to say, too, it strikes me that, you know, one of your first books was about safety climbing Denali, and that, too, speaks to your desire to affect change, that back then it was helping people not need to get rescued and to approach this intelligently.
Yeah, that was a wonderful opportunity. I worked as a mountaineering ranger on Denali and, you know, repeatedly rescued people injured and even in several instances dying or dead bodies. And I said to my boss, this is crazy. People are repeating the same mistakes of their predecessors here. Why don't I just write a book that identifies the patterns behind accidents? He said, well, if you find a publisher and I'll give you all our resources to help you do it. And I immediately found a publisher and wrote my first book. And it was a great lesson in figuring out who, not only figuring out who my audience was, but also doing a bit of a service, you know, probably saving more than a few lives.
Yeah.
I was at a book event in Seattle just a week ago, and lo and behold, my boss from 1982, who gave me the green light to write that book, whom I had not seen for 40 years, showed up at that lecture. It was a nice closing of the circle.
Yeah. Well, with that, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to remind folks that John Waterman will be giving a presentation about this book tomorrow at the Third Street Center at 7 p.m., and all donations at the door benefit the Sopris Sun. So there's not tickets. There's no fixed cost, but John is waiving his honorarium as a benefit to the Sopris Sun, for which we're very appreciative. There's an article I was told in today's Aspen Times about the book as well and this event coming up. What's your best pitch, John, for getting folks over there?
There will be refreshments. There'll be Izzy from White River Books will have my book there, and if anyone's interested in buying a copy, I'd be happy to sign it for them.
Mm-hmm. Great. And beyond just you speaking, you've got a slideshow and you'll be presenting.
Yeah, I will take the opportunity to share pictures and videos in a sort of more equally cohesive way to this interview, take people on a journey with me through the Arctic and show them what my book is about as well as what the Arctic is about.
Mm-hmm. And I can't say enough how beautiful the book is. I think it would make a great gift for any lover of science or adventure, poetry, nature. And if you can't make it to the event, I assume that Izzy will also have copies available at White River Books.
Yes, she will.
All right. Well, any final closing thoughts from you, John?
No, that about covers it. Thanks. I'll think of something as soon as we end our interview, but right now, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your support for the Soper Sun, and also the big ways in which you're influencing the world through your writing, through your craft. And good to see that you're continuing to photograph as well, and that this book is full of that.
Thank you.
This has been Everything Under the Sun. Stay tuned for the regional roundup coming up next.